okay, that's fine. Now I know what I have to do. Or I can give up. That's fine too. But I'm not going to give up, so I guess I'll just do it this way. Instead of trying to like shill to the pro teams, I'll just develop pitchers better than they ever could, which is an audacious thing to say, but I guess it was the only way forward. It's the only thing I could see that would cause them to listen to me. And turns out that I was able to do it, which I was pretty shocked that I did. But turns out that I guess if you work hard enough and you're kind of smart, it works out.
You're listening to Risk of Ruin. I'm John Reeder. This is episode 33, A Healthy Disrespect. I'm going to start off by saying a few words about great ideas. And when I say great ideas, I am using that term in air quotes. I'm half serious, half kidding. I'll just use this podcast as an example of a quote-unquote great idea. I started this show because I thought, hey, I bet I can make a podcast that I would want to listen to. And I'll just get interesting people to tell me their stories and, you know, how hard can it be? Well, when you're cold emailing the 200th potential guest with no response, or you're editing an episode wondering if even a single person is going to enjoy the show, or you're staring at a blank page trying to write something, anything, that's not completely obvious, well, at that point, the great idea has lost any sheen it once had, and the question becomes, wait, whose idea was this? It couldn't have been mine, because this is an idea only an idiot would think of, and, oh yeah, never mind, I'm an idiot. And the thing is that I actually love making this show. I'm very proud of the catalog. I love talking to smart people, and I've been very happy to watch it steadily grow. Also, I actually even love writing it, but I also hate all that stuff. It sucks. And also, I love it. The point I'm trying to make is that one day you have a great idea, and then from there, all you have to sustain this idea is your own stubbornness, because that original lightning bolt of inspiration is history. I don't know if that sounds familiar to you at all, but if it doesn't, I think hearing the story in this episode will get the point across. Kyle Bodie is best known today because he trains baseball pitchers, as in every level up to and including major league players. Also, to say that he trains pitchers is really underselling things, considering that baseball has undergone a revolution in velocity. And if you read an article about that trend, Kyle's name and the name of his company, Driveline Baseball, are almost always mentioned. But Kyle didn't start off by training Clayton Kershaw. He started off with a quote-unquote great idea. 15 years ago, he was just a guy renting space in a shithole business park so he could have a batting cage to work with his clients. And by the way, these early clients were players no one had heard of then and no one has heard of since. So I've been thinking about all of the terrible and amazing moments Kyle must have encountered along the way. The 15 years of complete frustration and also quiet, satisfying moments. The times where he made no money, followed by tiny indicators that maybe things would be okay. The years in the wilderness before the Cy Young winner walked into his facility. The story actually begins even before the batting cage in the business park. You might not be surprised to find out that it starts with gambling.
Yeah, at a young age, just big video games junkie, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And I remember one of my favorite video games growing up was Vegas Stakes for the Super Nintendo, which I literally had forgotten about until just right about now. And I'd always been enamored with the idea of gambling generally, right? Whether it's for a living, for fun, or for whatever. And growing up in Cleveland, Ohio, we just don't have casinos, you know, at the time, right? They were illegal. So, you know, it's just like so far away from my life, you know, like where could I even go do that? Obviously, the internet was not yet a thing. So I started playing Magic the Gathering, which I think a lot of people did as a kid. Through that, you know, that's stoked a lot of competition in me. I was a multi-sport athlete growing up, so a lot of that competition was kind of stoked in me generally. And so then I found, you know, oh, instead of just playing Nintendo games, you know, I can play against other people, like whether I play the Nintendo World Championship to Magic and playing in these tournaments of trying to play in the Pro Tour to make money, you know. And then I think like most Magic players, to be honest, you know, we see the movie Rounders, and then you get introduced to it by guys like David Williams and all these other Magic players that are now well known in the poker world. And then you turn to poker. So yeah, poker was the first thing, my first love, I guess.
We should probably have a full episode about Magic the Gathering at some point, because it's one of the well-known funnels for gamblers and games players. Anyway, when Kyle graduated from Magic to poker, he had an experience that's very common.
After I lost like $100, which is a hell of a lot of money to a 17-year-old kid or a 16-year-old kid, however much I had and however old I was, I was like, yeah, I should probably do some reading. And then, of course, the first book I bought was serendipitous, was The Theory of Poker. So got into some 2+2 books and then found the forums and was a moderator there for a while. That's kind of how I started my education right there.
Kyle has a free roaming mind. During our interview, we discussed chess, the NFL, the stock market. He mentioned maybe a couple of dozen pro athletes, a similar number of baseball executives, a bunch of gambling games, and a handful of programming jobs he's had. So with that kind of free roaming mind, you might guess that when Kyle was playing poker, he wasn't the kind of player just grinding no limit hold'em. Of course, Kyle played mixed games.
I read an essay by David Skolansky about how big bet poker was going to kill amateurs, which I think a lot of people laughed at him about. Of course, in hindsight, he's 100% right. Right. But yeah, I just took that pretty seriously. And I thought, man, everyone's talking about no limit hold'em, Chris Moneymaker's on TV, and that's all we're talking about. But it's getting sharp fast. And there's got to be these other games that no one has any clue what's going on. So I became a really good mid-high limit stud 8 and Omaha 8 or better player. And that's kind of what I made most of my money playing poker on. Right after college, I was playing mid-high Omaha 8 or better, specifically on Full Tilt. I had one of those 100% rake back accounts and was just crushing those 6 max games.
There's a perception of gambling as being a hard way to make an easy living. And I'll just say that phrase gets to the idea that the work won't be hard, but everything that surrounds the gambling is hard. Although, actually, if you talk to gamblers, you find these are people who have an always-on mind. The search for angles and the search for exploits is just how their brain works. And so, rather than looking for easy street, they're looking for something that can soak up all of their mental energy. In Kyle's case, the gambling not only offered an outlet for his mental energy, but it was also a professional outlet as well. He actually went to work at PokerStars.
Yeah, I worked from a young age, grew up in a below average income family in Cleveland. Mom worked, dad worked his ass off, you know, to put us through school and give us what we could, you know, and yeah, I can't say enough about my parents' work ethic. I mean, that's where I get it from. So I had a job when I was 14 at a pizza shop, and I always liked working. It was always part of my ethos. It's Irish Catholic family on the one side, Japanese American on the other. And it was just in our blood. It was just ingrained in us that we had to work. You know, that was the thing. So I was working full time when I was 16 years old, opted out of high school, went to junior college at a young age, took online classes so I could work full time at a young age. It was just always part of me. So the idea that I would gamble as a full time job wasn't taboo. It's not like my family shunned it. They just didn't understand what I was doing. But there was no pressure to not gamble full time. It just never felt like it was realistic until the casino bonusing online started happening. Like that's when I turned pro, I would say. But I was still also working for PokerStars.com. I was a game theorist for PokerStars. I applied my senior year of college. I wasn't doing well in school, depressed, anxious, just didn't like it, but didn't want to drop out because I had a full scholarship and I didn't want to like embarrass my parents. And I'd be the first to graduate college in my family. So there's a lot of pressure, you know? And then I applied to PokerStars one day. I think I was drunk, actually, the day I applied, which is very funny. And a couple days later, I got an email back from them, you know, do interviews and got the job. So I was able to drop out of college and work full-time at PokerStars.
Kyle told me that he thinks the best gamblers should be able to pick up expected value wherever it might be available. So he did some sports betting, and we're going to hear about how he hustled online casino bonuses, but he was also counting cards.
So we're playing at these shops, this double-deck pitch game, high penetration. I'm crushing it. I learned some new counting systems like high op 2 and I'm putting them through their paces, and I'm doing fine. Like I'm beating the shop pretty good. And this kid's there, and I know that he's also AP as well. And so he corners me kind of outside, and he was like, "Hey, man," and we're talking sports betting. Okay, fine. So we start to exchange some information, you know, Arnold's blackjack guide and all that, and we're just talking. Nope, no problem. I see him a couple weeks later, and he's like, "Dude, I got a tip for you." He's like, "Don't blow it up, though." And I was like, "Okay, you know, what do you got?" He's like, "There's this casino about an hour and a half north. You got to go. It's called Highway 9 Casino. It's in Lake Stevens." I'm like, "Dude, that's like out there." So like, why do I need to go? He's like, "I can't tell you." He's like, "You have to go on your own." I was like, that doesn't make any sense. You know, he's like, look, I'm not going to tell you, but like, you should go.
Kyle took a trip to scout this hole-in-the-wall casino, but when he got there, it looked like a bust. The table limit was just $200 with an 8-deck shoe, and the penetration on the game was unremarkable. It was not worth writing home about. But he stuck around to play a few hands, and when he did, he noticed that the shuffle was not very sophisticated.
Like, this is a hand shuffle, and one of the worst hand shuffles I've ever seen in my life. Like, this is like, imagine an 8-deck shoe cut twice, so four piles of 2 decks. They riffle the 2 decks together, stack them, hand you the decks. It's like, okay, literally, the 2 halves are not shuffled. Okay, I don't know what to do with this information, but that can't be right. Right, and then I think that's the essence of an advantage player, is that you see something and you don't know how to exploit it, but you know it's wrong.
Advantage players had been exploiting shuffles for a few decades by the time Kyle found this game. There have even been some things published about shuffle tracking. The best-known resource is the Shuffle Tracker's Cookbook by the late, great Arnold Snyder, who was a former guest of the show and sadly passed away just a few weeks ago.
I go home, and I just Google shuffle tracking. I'm like, I know it's a thing. I don't know what it is. And I just practice shuffle tracking. I have a shoe, I have a discard shoe, a discard tray, and I have everything at home to practice, right? And I've had that forever, just for counting, just because I like to work on that kind of stuff. I take pride in being a good technical expert in anything I do. And I'm like, I have to learn how to shuffle track. So I'm pulling up these articles from the 1980s, the 1990s. I mean, this is a dead art by what, 2000? I don't even know. Like, I don't even know. At no point had I ever seen anything like this. So it must have been a dead art in the 1990s, is my guess. So I'm reading like Ken Oosten articles and just crazy stuff from forever ago, you know. And I'm like, okay, you know, let's boil it down to count decks, right? Like get a sub count per deck and like track it every roughly 50 to 60 cards, right? And if I can get sub counts per thing, then watch them cut, then I can pick out the decks that have like +9 sections. And when they shuffle it with a deck that's neutral, then I know that pile is +4.5. Right. And then make sure that they don't. And every time I see that, manipulate the cut card. So they're going to cut to the front. So I have at least 2 to 4 decks of positive expectation off the top. Perfect. Like that's how I boiled it down. And how I would track it is I would keep a stack of 8 chips in front of me and I would have them all oriented the same way. And I would shuffle them. Like I would cut them. When they cut 4 decks, I would cut the 4. When they cut to 2, I would cut to 2. And for per count per deck, I would just do a notch. So like face of a clock. So the front of it, if it's 12, it's 0. And if I go to, you know, 11 o'clock, it's -1. And if I go to the right, it's +, you know, and then I could look down and I could see the rough orientation of the decks. And then eventually I got so good that I didn't need to do that, but I would just count these pockets. And then the best part of shuffle tracking, of course, as anyone will tell you, is that you're just betting table max off the top, and that there's nothing better than doing that, right? Like the pit boss is never going to isolate you, right? So it's on table max, 7 spots. Like maybe 1 in 10, 1 in 20 shoes, and they're loving it. Then I may have taken, I mean, this casino's in the middle of nowhere. I have to explain, you know, and I think the first day I won $21,000, and I think it like was literally probably their net theoretical for the entire month. Like just absolutely wiped out. And I beat him for, and of course you're running good, right? 21, you don't make 21 grand by being skilled. We both know that, right? So I have an edge, but what's my Theo? 3 grand? 2 grand? Maybe, right? That's clean enough, right? I take him for 21. I go back, I'm like, man, I hope I lose 5 grand or something. You know, I'm not going to give it away. But like, I smash him for 18,000 a week later. And it's like, oh my goodness. You know, fortunately, I went back and lost a little bit back here and there. But I mean, I bashed him again really bad. And then the casino like closed like shortly after that. So I don't know that I was responsible for it. But anyone out there listening, you can Google it and find out that the casino's long been closed.
One of the tough things about making a living as a brick and mortar AP is that it's a very tenuous existence. You're not going to find great shuffle tracking games and then run like God every day. I mean, you're not even going to find great counting games every day. It's just a very tough business. But Kyle had other opportunities that were juicy. We've heard about these online casino bonuses in past episodes because it really was a golden era. It literally made APs into millionaires.
Yeah, I mean, the original bonuses, right, were just deposit 100, get 100, play $2,000 worth of blackjack, cash out. Okay, obviously everyone knows that carries an expected value of, I don't know, $88 to $92, right, if you play perfectly. And then, okay, fine, we're going to exclude blackjack. Okay, no problem, we're going to play roulette. All right, well, you know, we're going to increase the wager requirement. Okay, you know, and then it's just a constant you know, battle, but these are all very linear and easy to model, right? And then all the casinos kind of switch to the sticky bonuses, right? Which I'm sure they talked about, right? Where it's like deposit 600, get 300, can't cash out that 300, play them as lammers, right? Obviously, that's existed in Vegas for decades, right? Match play coupons, effectively, right? And more like lammers than they are match play coupons, a little bit of a difference, but same idea, right? And then, okay, we're going to play blackjack. We're just going to stage large bets, right? Where the meme that I actually saw on Twitter is going around is very funny, where it's like you can win an infinite amount of money, but you can only lose your bankroll, which is like a hilarious, like degenerate gambling meme. But actually, there's a lot of truth in it, actually, when it comes to bonuses, right? That's exactly how you should play.
There's a paper by James Grosjean titled Beyond Coupons, which lays out the math for various casino promotions and which shows the relationship that exists between variance and free bet expected value. And so what Kyle's saying there is backed up by the math. The downside is very limited, and the upside provides the clue as to the correct strategy. Kyle hadn't read the Beyond Coupons paper, but he did his own simulations, and he also tested his theory in the casinos.
Each net teller account, you know, was worth probably $18,000 in casino bonuses. That's just a lot of money to be sneezing at, you know, to do whatever. And, you know, at the beginning, you're just playing blackjack. You know, I won a Starluck cruise, so I actually went on the Starluck / Party Poker cruise because I crushed it on my main account, and it was hilarious to go on that cruise with my then girlfriend, now wife, that I won on that, which was really funny. But you just kind of learn at the end of the day. For me, I don't know how other people see it. I've talked to a lot of people who feel this way. Just expected value is expected value. You know, wherever I can pick it up, I'm going to do it. You know, and that's just, I think, the mind of a businessman, you know, and that's just how I saw it at the end of the day. Like EV is EV, and if it's sitting out there, someone's going to grab it. And as casino bonus abuse got tougher, it became much more challenging and much more intellectually stimulating. You know, these casinos are releasing bonuses that they were sure were unbeatable, and by all modeling was unbeatable. And, you know, we actually had to derive, that's where my econ and mathematics background actually played a big role. You know, we modeled these and did Monte Carlo simulations, but then also some pretty advanced calculus to show that these bonuses, when modeled in a linear fashion, were definitely right. You know, whoever consultants they were paying definitely were correct that these had negative expected return. But by modeling them differently, you know, in ways that people hadn't thought, we were able to at least theoretically show that they had positive expected return. And then that's when you go there and do that. And then does it really, when the rubber meets the road, do you really win the money? And then we were able to do it. We were able to drive multiple online casino places out of business, or to change their rules in ways they never thought they would have to. And that was actually very intellectually stimulating.
The casino bonuses illustrate an idea which I have heard a lot of advantage players talk about, which is that there are various levels. So when there's something that's really inefficient, even casual people can figure out how to exploit it. You might have seen that happen with sportsbook free bets. It just doesn't take a genius to figure it out. But as things get tighter, it requires more and more expertise, to the point that only the really sharp people can figure out how to make money.
Okay, they get on, they get wise. If you play blackjack ever, your balance is voided. Okay, fine. All right, now we're starting to get into these areas where most people are giving up. But it just turns out that, you know, roulette can be smashed this way, although that was known. And then when they started excluding roulette, and they're like, okay, only slots can be played. And that's when 99.99% of people gave up. Or they're just like, slots carry at least a 5% house edge. Could be rigged. No way to verify, right? I guess it's true about anything, but like slots had this dogma around it. And then we were able to just show that huge wagering in slots with the variance is actually maybe what we should have been playing all along. Because maybe the house edge doesn't actually matter that much if you can just create massive variance against lammers. You know, and then that's the amount of work that we put in to really show that there was an exploitable way to bet slots with lammers, with exclusions, and actually take them down for quite a bit of money. And that's actually where we saw the majority of our profits, is when we switched to this last-ditch effort, when maybe in reality we should have always been doing it.
I think Kyle's background in gambling is interesting because he had his hand in so many different aspects. But let's move on to baseball, where I think the striking part of the story is that Kyle was able to figure things out even as a total outsider.
You know, I went broke. You know, like I went broke in gambling fast. You know, like I didn't know how to manage my money. I think about a scene from Siriana, if you've seen that movie, when they say, like, you know, they're in Dubai or whatever. And like Matt Damon's character is talking about, like, you know, a couple thousand years ago, these people were chopping each other's heads off. And now it's, you know, they're looking at the Burj Khalifa or whatever. It's billions of dollars, right? Crazy. And he's like, in a couple thousand years, they'll go back to doing it, you know? And that's how it is when you grow up in Cleveland and you always worry about money and you never have any, right? And then you become what is effectively a millionaire. Then I am still someone from Cleveland who doesn't know anything, right? And that's the NBA. It's broke, right? It's all those people, right? The exact same thing happened to me, right? So what I thought I liked about gambling, I bring that story up because what I thought I liked about gambling was the money. Because when you don't have any, that's what you idolize, you know? And it took a long time for me in therapy and otherwise to realize what I really loved about gambling was the intellectual challenge and the fact that I was beating somebody, like, and competing. That's what I loved.
If you go through the names of Major League general managers, you will find a bunch of people that started very low on the org chart. Like, guys who went to Ivy League colleges, but started their careers as the intern to the scouting department. So not exactly the kind of job that the parents of a Yale student are dreaming about when they send their tuition checks. From that standpoint, Kyle's entry into baseball isn't that crazy. It's a weird world with a bunch of people who were forced to buck convention. But even in a world full of unique stories, Kyle ends up sticking out.
My girlfriend's father was a pretty well-known softball coach. And he said, you know, like, I told him, I said, like, I think I kind of maybe want to coach baseball. And he said, yeah, I can get you hooked up with the Little League, local Little League. So Northeast Seattle Little League. And so I don't know anything about coaching. I know I don't know anything. So I'm like, you know what? I'm going to read Moneyball and all these books about baseball and coaching. And the more I read, the more I was like, these people are like really stupid. Like, this just doesn't make any sense. You know, like, I'm not saying I'm an expert, but just no. There's no way this is right.
If we're talking about baseball from a quant standpoint, then we have to talk about Moneyball, which is really interesting because the content of the book seems quaint in hindsight, right? Like, on-base percentage, that's the big revelation. And I'm sort of strawmanning Moneyball, but it really was fairly primitive. Although I will also admit that it's completely unfair to take a book that launched a revolution and then later judge it by the new standards of the revolution it birthed. But the way that Moneyball framed ability was also key for Kyle to find his edge.
What I took from it is, like, I read the chapters on Scott Hatterberg and, you know, Miguel Tejada. And I remember very specifically the minor footnote in the story. It's like Miguel Tejada is going to make an error. And Billy Bean is like, he's going to make another because he does too much. Right. And he strikes out too much. And the duality of, like, Billy Bean saying you need to walk a lot in the minor leagues. And we need to teach them how to walk a lot. But he also believed that you couldn't teach anyone in the big leagues how to walk a lot. And Michael Lewis kind of just doesn't expand on it. I said, like, that doesn't make sense. You can't believe both things. Like, you know, either you have it or you don't. And that's true, which I don't think is true. Right. Or it's a teachable skill. Can't be both, you know. And then when I actually talked to Michael Lewis, I was on his podcast. Michael Lewis said, he's like, that is like the one thing that bothered me the most about writing the book is that Billy, like, did not believe in player development. He's like, it was so weird.
There are probably a lot of baseball enthusiasts who would love to do what Kyle has done, although they might be less enthused once they consider the reality of the grind that it required.
2 years Little League, then I coached high school for 2 years. And then I think, like a lot of coaches, the grift is that you just get those kids to pay you for private lessons, you know, which I did for a little bit, but then is just a stupid business model and also like kind of a scam to, like, you know, pay me $60 an hour to teach you how to pitch. Just really dumb. You know, so then I moved to a model. There was a guy named Eric Cressy, who's still around. You know, he's running a great business in baseball, too. We're theoretically competitors, I guess, but we're friends. And, you know, it's like a semi-private training model. You know, pay per month, like $200, and come in and train as much as you want. And that, this way we'll get the most dedicated people. And that's what I did. I opened up a little place inside of a batting cage, inside of a little league below an Aikido studio and next to a strip club, which was a great place. But it's really all you can afford, you know, and did that. And we probably had 5 clients total for 3 years. So, like, basically nobody.
One reason that a story like Kyle's will be inherently rare is that most people with his ability are not going to endure the years that were required to build up this business. Kyle had skills as a programmer. He had worked at Microsoft. It was easy for him to get good job offers. But he was in a little bit of a catch-22. The thing he wanted to do made no money, and the thing he was good at made a lot of money. He just hated it.
Basically, what kept me going is I'm working a job. You know, at this point, I'm working a series of jobs. I'm done at Microsoft, and now I'm in software development, and I'm working a series of jobs as a software developer, which is funny because when I was 16, 17, 18 years old, I always told myself I never wanted to be a software developer. I knew from a young age. But I just assumed that was stupid back then. You know, I took those career tests and they said I should be a systems analyst and whatever. And so I just bought into it. It turns out like they're more right than I thought. And I'm working programming jobs, right? First job, I remember making $85,000. And I was like, this is sick. It's going to make me happy. It just doesn't. You're working on tax software and shit you don't care about, you know? And so every interview, I'm job hopping because I don't like where I'm at. Plus, I know I can make more money. So I went to a company and I remember just being belligerent in the interview. I was just like, I want like $160,000 and I want 2 months of paid time off and ridiculous demands, you know? But because I'm an economist and I know how to manipulate numbers and write a little bit of code, and from what I guess I interview well from what they say, I get this offer. And I said, okay, but I want a brand new Retina MacBook Pro. And they just come out. You know, they're totally sold out. Can't get anyone. And the boss offers me his. He's like, if you come on, you can have my MacBook. And I was like, okay. And, you know, this whole time I'm just like angling for more money and more status and bigger title. And I was a data scientist before that was a real thing and whatever. And it just doesn't make you happy. It makes you just really, you know, mad that I knew deep down that what I was doing wasn't what I wanted to do with my life, you know, and that's what keeps the other stuff going, I think, is I was profoundly unhappy in my day job, just every day going to work with people that have no social skills, working on stuff that just ultimately doesn't matter, you know, and making a lot of money for a skill set that I don't even really like, you know, and I think a lot of people who come out of gambling that try to join the real world have that exact same problem, right? Because every day your adrenaline is so high. Right. You can work every day, every hour of the day. How many gamblers just have acute sleeping issues, right? And are just addicted to Ritalin and stimulants because at any time you could just be making money. So when you lay down to go to sleep, your brain is like, you're flushing $800 down the toilet or whatever, you know? So I think all that adrenaline, you're so used to that every day at your job, quote unquote, that when you go to work every day and it's boring and it doesn't matter, you start to think like, well, I'm not stimulated at work. So I think a lot of that played the role in that I knew that when I went to the cages, when I got off the bus and I went home, I changed and I walked through a trailer park to get to my place of work or the facility, which was great. And I got to work, you know, I was just like, I really love doing this every day. So I would do this for nothing. If nothing comes of this, I still, if today I was in the same place I was 18 years ago, I guarantee I would still be doing it because it just doesn't matter to me. Like I loved it so much and I still do. It was never about the money.
If we cast Kyle's journey as just a case of work hard, follow your passion, and good things will happen, then I think it will miss a key part of the story. Kyle is a very good promoter, and so he was able to get attention for the things he was working on. I have this theory that every small business is ultimately a marketing business, which is just a theory, but I think that Kyle's ability to market himself is at least a data point in my favor.
Started blogging a lot. And I think that's kind of what caught the attention of people is when I started writing for SB Nation and for the Hardball Times. And I was writing a lot for free, obviously, but just publishing my thoughts on baseball. And because I guess I'm a decent writer from what people tell me, or compared to baseball, it is. You know, I'm not going to win any Pulitzer Prizes, but like compared to like the average baseball coach, I'm probably pretty literate, you know? And that caught the attention of some general managers and that caught the attention of some people. And once the high school kids do well, you talk about it, then these college players who are no good will give you a chance. My first college player was a kid out of Harvard, side-arming righty, gave me a chance. I was so ecstatic that a kid from college would give me a chance, you know. And then the first professional guy that gave me a chance was Ryan Buchter, who I'm still very close with. And Ryan, yeah, was a guy stuck in AAA, never able to get out of the minor leagues. And my first pro client got to the big leagues. And my second pro client got to the big leagues. And I like to say it's been downhill ever since. So it's like one of those. I think writing, blogging was a big, big factor for me. Much like I think that social media is what gets people attention these days, blogging was big 12, 13 years ago.
In our episode titled Greetings from Las Vegas, the sports bettor Rufus Peabody said that before he became a professional gambler, he read some 90 academic papers on sports betting. I think about that a lot because even if you have what you think might be a new approach, it really helps to know what's already been tried. Well, Kyle embarked on a similar journey when he started. He read everything he could find.
I had arm injuries as a kid, and I also did later in life. And I thought, you know, the one thing I do want to get right is I want to make sure these kids' arms, their arms are okay, you know, at the end of playing Little League or high school or professional baseball, wherever they end up, there has to be an answer in academic literature that's going ignored on how to keep people healthy. There must be. So I read every article I could, you know, paid a lot of money back then. There was no Sci-Hub, and just reading as much as I could about arm injuries. And it just turns out that no one knows anything. It's like, oh my God. Like that's terrifying.
There's this idea in gambling, which is that as soon as you start talking about an edge or, God forbid, publish anything, that it will get killed immediately. And probably that is correct-ish, but there are also some amazing exceptions to this rule, and Kyle found one of them. One of the key insights that can help pitchers throw harder was just sitting out there for anyone who cared to look.
I was reading all these Soviet research journals on javelin and shot put and discus, and they all use overload-underload implements, right? If the javelin weighs 400 grams, then they throw javelins that are 600 and 200 grams, right? I don't exactly know how much they weigh, right? But it's commonly understood, and it has been for 80 plus years, possibly 100, that this is one of the best ways to train people. And one of the most well-respected sports scientists in the world, Anatoly Bondarchuk, wrote a lot about it. And American sports scientists have too, right? And American track and field people train this way. They use variable implements, they call them. And baseball is just throwing. I mean, that's a big part of pitching, right? It's a prerequisite for pitching. And that sounds really trite, I think, to the listeners and probably you, right? But it is not very well understood even to this day, that pitching is also throwing, right? They think that it's not. They think it's different, right? And yes, okay, the goal of the javelin athlete is different than the goal of the pitcher, because the person who throws the javelin the furthest wins, right? Aroldis Chapman doesn't win when he throws 105 mile an hour fastball. That's right, of course. But this is exactly your notes is about when there's a lot of randomness, there's a lot of snake oil. And that's the exact same thing here, is that the person that throws the hardest isn't always the best pitcher, right? So then it must mean that throwing hard does not matter, right? Like that's to the extent that people believe things in anything, right? They're deterministic. They're not probabilistic, right? So this concept that throwing harder was always important to me at a young age, or like through developing this, and I believe we could develop velocity, but people just said you couldn't. And when I stumbled upon these papers about the weighted implements, it had been about a year I was reading these. And then one day I stumbled upon a guy named Dr. Coop Duren in the University of Hawaii. And Coop had been using weighted balls with his pitchers. And his peer-reviewed research journals, not like blogs, peer-reviewed papers in reputable journals, proved without a shadow of a doubt that these things could help pitchers throw harder. And it was obvious. The differences were not just significant, they were large. The effect size was large. He wrote a book with an ISBN and everything. Buy it on Amazon. It's like, not only that, but like a book that you could read. And people just like didn't care. They don't care to this day, which is crazy. But like back then, they didn't care either, you know, which was like, holy shit, this is a secret that no one knows about. And so I said, okay, we have to try this. We have to replicate this. Is this real? You know, my mind doesn't go to this works, so let's use it. My mind goes to, I need to collect first party data to see if this is actually accurate. Yes, it's in a medical journal, but I need to know, you know, myself. So then we advertised for free, like come in and throw these weighted balls and put it through a research trial. And the results were so staggeringly crazy that I was like, holy shit, no one is doing this. Like this is a chance to revolutionize baseball. This product can be that. And that was the first time when I thought, okay, maybe there is a future here. You know, that's probably the first time that I was really like, okay, there is a thing here.
In the back of the mind of every sports analytics hobbyist is this idea that someday a pro team will call them up and ask for all of their unique and brilliant insights into the game. Well, that's actually happened to Kyle.
The Tampa Bay Rays have been courting me. You know, there's a guy named Josh Kalk who's emailing me. And Josh, obviously, now is a really well-known person. He works for the Minnesota Twins. I think he's an assistant general manager. He knows more about pitching than I think possibly anyone in the world, including me. And Josh had wrote for me on my blog when he was a nobody. He was a professor at Bluefield State, I think, in West Virginia. And, you know, he's working for Tampa. He gets his chance. And, of course, I'm jealous, you know, but also, like, I really respect Josh. So he's telling the Rays they need to hire me, they need to hire me, they need to hire me. So I'm getting calls from a guy named Matt Arnold, who's the director of pro scouting, probably the number 6 in the organization at the time. Matt Arnold now runs the Milwaukee Brewers. Matt is like, hey, we're going to be in town. We're going to play Seattle, and we always go on a West Coast golf trip. And so the whole front office is going to be there. We want to meet with you and possibly interview you. I said, okay, great.
Kyle remembers the exact day that he met with the team execs because Mariners pitcher Felix Hernandez threw a perfect game against the Rays that day. Kyle was worried that this would put the Rays execs in a less than ideal mood, but he says they shrugged it off pretty easily. Although his meeting also didn't go the way he was hoping, but for other reasons.
And the group of people that I'm interviewing with is Matt Arnold, Chaim Bloom, you know, now the president of the Red Sox, Eric Neander, now the GM there, James Click, then now the, formerly the president of the Astros, and Andrew Friedman, you know, now the president of the Dodgers. So it's a star-studded group even then, you know, and they're taking me through it, kind of going through the interview, and they like what I have to say. But by and large, without repeating exactly what Andrew tells me, they're just like, baseball's not ready for this. Because Tampa, and they taught me a lot about front office dynamics, which is like Tampa Bay at the time, and today too, they're known for developing pitchers, right? And one of the executives that I named said to me, he's like, do you think that I think that we do a good job developing pitchers? I said, I don't know the answer to that, you know? And he said, right, I have no idea if we develop pitchers well, but I know that we have developed pitchers well, and that maybe, that doesn't mean much to me. He's like, but what it matters to is the coaches. Like, they think they do a good job. And whether they are right or not, bringing in someone to change the status quo when things are going well is hard. And I said, oh, I never really thought of it that way. He said, yeah, so the best thing you can do, which is advice you don't want to hear, is to develop a company and train players and force our hand, like, as these players come up. He's like, and I realize that that's going to take a long time. He's like, but, you know, like, that's the best way to make change in this game. He's like, you won't, even if I gave you the job you want, you won't be able to make the change you think. Because, like, it starts with the players. It doesn't start with the teams. And that was a really somber ride home. Obviously, I really appreciated the time. You don't get to speak to people like that, you know, when you're a nobody. But I remember Andrew sitting down, and he could reel off, like, three blog posts I had written. And I was like, holy shit, these guys actually read my stuff. You know, because they're not leaving comments on their blog. You don't know. You have no idea. You know, so Andrew's like, I've read all your stuff. Here's this. I think it's right. And here's why we're not going to do it. You know, and then other people in that front office kind of had the conversation I just brought up. And I said, oh, so it really is hopeless. You know, I'm like, I really do have to do it on my own. You know, and that he was very apologetic. And they were like, look, sorry, that's the answer you didn't want. But at least it gave me clarity. And I think that was very motivating. It was like, okay, so I do have to prove everyone wrong.
So after this meeting, Kyle knew that his way into baseball wouldn't be through a team. Here was this progressive team full of people who approach baseball the right way, and they were telling him that it wouldn't work. And that's the meeting where Kyle said he realized he would have to show teams that he could develop pitchers better than they could. And he did it. When a pitcher is wondering if they can add velocity, Driveline has the data to show what their program can do. And they also have a reputation. Throwing weighted balls is part of it, but there's also a lot more.
It like Xerox and Kleenex, right? Driveline has become a verb, right? Like, oh, this guy does driveline. That's a very common phrase, which invariably means that they throw weighted balls. You know, okay, fine. That's part of what we do, right? But the cool thing about driveline 15 years ago and the cool thing about today, and I hope forever, is that there's a quote from Mythbusters that I kind of ascribe to, Adam Savage. And Adam Savage just says that the difference between fucking around in science is writing the results down. Like, and I thought that was such a profane, like, not profane, I thought it was profane too, right? But I thought it was like a profound saying that, like, shooting off cannons and doing all this bullshit is just really fucking around. But a difference is actually writing the results down in the process. And I thought that was really beautiful. And we've always done that. We've always collected data. We've always done it from, like, what works, what doesn't. And that was in weightlifting. That was in throwing. That was in analytics. That was in sales, customer service, pricing, you know, just everything we did, we wrote down and fanatically recorded when I knew for a fact that for years this data would be fucking worthless, right? But one day, maybe it wouldn't be, right? And turns out that I was right about that, you know, and that's the thing we have never changed. So the tagline, and for to put it in more concrete terms for listeners who don't want to hear about that shit, which I don't blame them, is that we're data-driven. What makes us different is that we're data-driven development, right? Like, our players get better and we constantly test the results against, we constantly test the process against the results, period. We follow up. What's our injury rate over time? do these players get better in the minor leagues? Do they get better in the major leagues? What did they get better at? What did we say we were going to improve in them? We're going to increase their bat speed. Okay, did it actually improve in the game? Right? Like, okay, did? Okay, well, if we increase their bat speed, what's the second order derivative that should change? Their power should change. Great. Did that change? Yes. Awesome. No. Okay, then we suck. Right? Or like, what did we do with these players? And we do A-B testing with all of our groups. So then we know which experiments, you know, which things work. When we know that there's a core of things that work, 80%, and 20% of the things we're not sure, we'll do A-B testing with the 20%. And then because to the athletes, it's fair. It's not like we're holding out an intervention that we know that works. We actually don't know, right? And we're going to test 50-50 so that when they come back, we do know within 1 year enough data, right? Like anyone who's listening to this is going to be like, yeah, no shit, Kyle. Like every business runs this way. And I'm here to tell you that literally no businesses run that way in professional sports. None. Not one. Not any major league organization. Not any of our competitors such that we have them. None do that. Like our biggest strength is that we have the audacity to run Driveline like you would run Google. I guess like that's a genius thing. But realistically, it's just how you should run a business.
Kyle spent much of his career outside of Major League Baseball, doing his own work, developing his own IP. But at some point, even the most hardened rebel will want to see if their ideas can work on the inside. In 2019, Kyle joined the Reds as their minor league pitching coordinator, and then the next year was promoted to director of pitching.
When I took my first job in professional baseball, I did so because I knew for a fact that there was an opportunity that was going to go away. Because all my employees get poached. We're up to 40 now. People that have been taken from us for Major League Baseball. So I knew for a fact that these positions at the senior director level would be full and I wouldn't get my opportunity again. So I wanted to see if I could do it. And I got three offers. And Dick Williams from the Reds was the best. Like he ran a hedge fund. He understood business, which is what I was passionate about. He understood how to build an organization and he knew where his weaknesses were. And he was a motherfucker to work for. He was a hard guy to work for, which is what I want. I want a boss who has expectations and it stays on me. He's not unfair. He's just tough, which is good. And it was such a great challenge. Then he left the organization and the alignment kind of went away. So it is what it is. But I saw my opportunity and we executed. Everyone in baseball will know forever. I try not to brag. I try not to be that guy. But the truth is that everyone will know what we did in the minor leagues. And it's just very obvious that we were better at it than anyone else on a budget, a tenth of the size of the largest organization. Like, okay. But then part of you is unfulfilled. Like, I know I can do it at the biggest level. I know I can run a team on how we draft players and develop them. I know I can do it. And I know I have the right team in place. I know that I can bring the people in and take over something. So it's one of those things where you're just waiting for an owner who sees it as clearly as you and wants to do it the way that you do it. Like if I got, and you can mention this on the podcast, but I've turned down multiple AGM jobs and director level jobs because I don't believe in the vision. So I'm not lacking for opportunity. It's just, if I run into another Dick Williams who wants to run an organization like a business and actually like hold people accountable and care about the outputs, then yeah, hell yeah, I want to do it.
I was interested to ask Kyle about messaging around claims of physical benefits. This will sound antiquated because cable TV sort of doesn't really exist anymore, but once upon a time, if you stayed up late enough, you'd see all kinds of commercials for stuff like copper arm sleeves or copper bracelets or copper knee braces. I mean, everything was copper, and the idea was that it was going to help you physically. Actually, that's where the original term snake oil comes from. Because there's so much noise in the way our bodies work, it's perfect for hucksters that make claims that aren't backed by science. And let me actually take that one step further. Imagine you have a real product that you know works, but you also see how effective snake oil sales tactics are at convincing people. Could you use the snake oil tactics for a real business, i.e. one that's not bullshit, one that has research to back up its claims?
Yeah, it's the eternal question, not only outward facing, but what can you ethically handle? Right? Can you use the same snake oil peddling techniques knowing that you're delivering a real product and they're not? And I struggle with that because do the means justify the ends, right? Like that's the real question, right? An unanswerable question in human society in general. And at least the way that I see it is that someday, you know, when it's all said and done, I would rather be the company that was pushing. Yeah, we do Facebook ads and vertical stuff and there's more clickbait than I would be comfortable with, but it is what it is. You know, like, yeah, you have to make some concessions in how you reach kids, you know, and how you reach people, knowing that we're selling a good product. Absolutely. I'm not going to sit here and sit on a fucking high horse, you know, but like, I'm very passionate about publishing research and publishing these things openly and proving that we do things because, yes, I do very much believe that that is the best sales tactic. And I also think in a society when everyone has a phone and Google, it's hard to run. It's hard to be a snake oil salesman. I think some people would argue that it's easier. I actually don't agree. I think kids these days, they're so quick to fact check you. They don't believe shit. Like I've said it a lot. And the evidence proves it. Kids today are more anti-authoritarian than ever. Like, and I don't think that's bad or good, right? I personally believe it's good, but like that's because I'm a rebel. So fine, right? But kids these days don't listen to their elders, right? And I don't think it's just a generational thing when people are like, oh, these kids don't listen. Obviously, every generation has said that. I think it's very true. And I think for good reason, because people just say stuff and this next generation of kids, mine included, but like more younger than me, they just Google stuff or they check Twitter, you know, like they could just fact check you any moment of the day. Right. And so we're raising a generation of people who don't trust what they're told and constantly fact check stuff. Does that lead them to disinformation sites sometimes? Yes. Does that lead them to believe false things that are on the internet? Yes, absolutely. But by and large, I think we're losing that in the signal, which is that people are always going to check what you say. If you're a coach, a parent, an authority figure, a teacher, they're just going to Google you, period. Like they're going to find everything about you. And they're going to ask questions. And if you like can't, you know, provide evidence, they're going to lose trust. And so I think that is the society we live in. And I think that is a good thing.
Part of Driveline's strategy to ensure that their claims can be verified is to publish peer-reviewed research. Kyle has been a co-author of a handful of academic studies. Another part of their strategy is to just track the results of their clients and to show that they're providing value.
We test our gains and our projections against the public markets, right? Against betting markets and against Steamer projections, which are kind of known to be the most accurate, but we'll use Zips and the other projections too. And if you train here and the projections are out and like this is wins above replacement, for those who don't know, you know, that's the kind of how we use, that's how we model players in baseball. It's imperfect, but it works generally. And 1.0 wins above replacement is worth about $13 million on the open market. That's observed behavior. When people can buy free agents, that typically tends to be the going rate for a player that has wins above replacement below like 5. You know, so like that's almost all players. That's not Mike Trout. Okay. Our players over the past 2 years exceed their projected wins above replacement total by half. So 0.5 war, not half the total. 0.5 war, which means that we produce about $6.5 million in excess value per player that trains here. It costs a lot less to train here than that, by the way. A lot less. but once we can quantify that, we can send it to the agents who obviously are like, that's great. I want to earn 5% of that, you know, and I want my players to do well. And then the players can actually like take a look at that data. And that resonates with some percentage of the people. And that's great. And that's what we're about. Like, are we a testable? Can we test our hypotheses? And that's what we've been about for 15 years. And yeah, what's changed is that we have millions of dollars more of equipment. And we've published 4 research papers now that are peer reviewed. And, you know, we're much more reputable. But the one thing that hasn't changed, and I'm fucking proud of it, man, if Driveline doesn't do anything else or we go bankrupt or whatever, at least we've always been about data driven development. And we run this organization like a successful gambler manages a syndicate.
In some ways, this entire episode has been about attacking market efficiency. That's what Kyle was doing as a gambler when he went after online casino bonuses. And that's what he's been doing with his business in baseball. Markets are supposed to be generally efficient. And so there shouldn't be exploits large enough for a total outsider to attack them. But market efficiency is a funny thing because it's almost always a valid assumption. It's just that the almost is doing a lot of work in that sentence. The almost is where 100% of the value is located. So when should you be willing to believe that the status quo is ripe to exploit?
I think it's always right to start on the side of reverence. You stand on the shoulders of giants. That's absolutely true. And you should look to them for answers. You know, you should respect your elders and you should see. Because, you know, a large percent of the time, the problem is solved. There are so many things in professional baseball and professional sports in general that seem so fucking stupid to the average fan that are actually like totally logical if you actually get in and understand it. But that's not everything, right? There's a large minority of issues in professional sports that are very stupid for reasons that don't matter and are dumb, you know? And if, you know, if these professional sports, the best way I can put it is if it was a free market, if it was a freer market, which you do see in the EPL and in soccer, these teams are so much faster to evolve because being relegated is so bad, right? It hurts so bad to be relegated. And the benefit for promotion is not linear. It's a step function, right? It's not even exponential or geometric, right? You go from 0 to 1 if you're promoted, and you go from 1 to 0 if you're relegated. So the pressure is there. But what are the chances that someone's going to lose their organization for running it like shit? The answer is nobody. Like, these organizations continue to print money. Valuations keep going up. The Colorado Rockies are going to lose 100 games for the next 10 fucking years. Like, it's one of the worst run organizations in baseball and in the country. Like, if you could short the Rockies, I would call the guy from your last episode and I would tell him to do it. Like, but also not, because, like, I would actually tell him not to. Like, if you could short their win total, you absolutely would. But, like, the team is still going to print money because it's Coors Field, 30,000 people show up. Denver's a great city and it's a beautiful park and they enjoy baseball. That's great. It's an entertainment product, right? But I think that that's not what fans actually really want, right? Like, fans think that their interests are aligned with the owners, and just a large percentage of the time they're not, which is, like, very hard for fans to understand.
The title of this episode is A Healthy Disrespect, which came from something that Kyle said, and I just really like that phrase. To go back to the quote-unquote great ideas I mentioned at the top of the show, they only come from what you might call disrespect. It's an attitude of, how hard can this be? And having that cocksure attitude can definitely get you in trouble, but cocksure mixed with tenacity is a dangerous combination going in the other direction. Kyle told me about this idea of healthy disrespect, which he was trying to relay to a coworker with the Reds.
So my coworker, pitching coordinator with the Reds, is an older man in his 50s who has very little education when it comes to technical stuff. And he would be the first to admit he's not the brightest bulb in the shed. Right? But he grew up in abject poverty, lived a very hard life, right? Raised a son who was a hell of a college pitcher and played professionally. And then his other son has cerebral palsy. He has, like, debilitating, you know, disabilities to the point where he's blind and deaf, and raised a daughter, and has had a hell of a hard life and would never complain about anything. But I know for a fact, like, that I didn't care how smart he was. I cared about the character, and I just knew that this guy knew how to work more than anyone I knew I've ever met in my life. And he was probably one of the best hires I've ever made in my life at any company. And I was going to teach him. We would do this thing where we teach each other something every week, and he would teach me about farms. He would teach me about other stuff. And I told him, I want to teach you computer programming. He's like, no, I'm not good with computers, man. You know that. I said, I think what you need is a healthy disrespect of that. Like, and that's what I've always used, is healthy disrespect. It's when people say, like, I can't learn this, I can't learn that. They elevate it into being this thing that either they're not smart enough, or more importantly, that this thing is unknowable, that maybe I have to go to college for it, or I can't do that, or whatever. And what I told him is, like, I'm going to teach you to disrespect, like, this thing of programming, and I'm going to teach you that it is nothing more than logic. You know, it doesn't mean that you're going to know how to program, but I want you to know that when these people are, like, saying that these things can't be done or whatever, that you at least understand that they're full of shit.
When I talk to our guests who are gamblers and then go on to do something else, I'm always trying to find some answer to the question, is this correlation or causation? Are we just dealing with general intelligence here, i.e. the same intelligence used to play games is also kind of helpful with other risk pursuits? Or is there something about gamblers that makes them unique? Do they learn special skills, or do they share some personality traits? And I've gotten different answers to this question. Also, over the years, it's become increasingly popular for this analogy to show up when sports is discussed. Today, there are owners who made money in the markets. There are executives that spent time at places like Bear Stearns. I even read an article about the Astros rebuild that said one of their analytics guys dealt blackjack in college, and he took from that an understanding that the human mind is very bad at calibrating on close percentages. And so this kind of thing is coming up more and more, and it's one of our favorite topics on this show.
I think poker and gambling is one way to learn a scarce trait. I don't think it's the only way, because Andrew Friedman is as skilled as a gambler as I am, if not more, and I really have no clue if Andrew gambles at all. I don't know, right? But he traded derivatives. Right. And I think that's, as long as you understand how to model risk, as long as you understand how not to be risk averse, if you understand risk reward and you understand loss aversion, and not from an academic perspective, but you have it in you, there's one thing to study it. You know, econ knew a lot about econometrics, right? I was a really good student. I loved econ. I still do, right? But there's, as everyone can tell you, it is very different. Can you hold your shit together when you bust the eighth $15,000 bonus in a row? And the answer to me is no. The first seven I could, and the eighth one I threw my butt back through a wall. So, you know, like, there's a breaking point for all of us. Yeah, I think that's, you have to understand risk and you have to have been in the arena. And I think there's a lot of ways to do it. And you have to love it. You have to love it. And gambling is maybe the best way to do it. I don't know for sure. But I would guess that trading derivatives and trading Forex and crypto and all that is also another way to do it. I think it's all the same.
As Kyle says, one thing that gamblers learn is a basic numeracy. They learn the math of risk and reward. But he says that gamblers also learn a mindset or an attitude.
It teaches you how to be ruthless. It just teaches you that it is zero sum. You know, and against the casinos, poker, it's negative sum, right? The casino is all a willing participant in taking money out of the game, right? So it teaches you to become ruthless, to become competitive, and to do things that are in your best interest. Obviously, you have to balance that with keeping an ecosystem solid, right? You can't just keep taking money from people, you know, forever, right? But how can you extend it by, you know, being good to them, giving them action elsewhere, right? And things like that. They're all things that great gamblers know. And that's the same as running an organization, which I didn't understand until much later, is you have a lot of people who are extremely intelligent and maybe clever too, but they're not ruthless, right? There are people that are making their organization worse and they don't have it in them to let them go because maybe they were a former player for the organization. Maybe they have a lot of weight with the organization. Maybe they mean something to people and firing them will become politically inexpedient. Maybe it will make their job less likely to renew and all these other things. And that's the type of coward that exists everywhere in this world, but very much in professional sports. It's why things don't move fast in professional sports. General managers make anywhere between $2 and $5 million a year, and that's a hell of a lot of money for them. And if they could just hang on for a couple more years, they're set for life. Well, Driveline is worth quite a bit more than that, and I own over 50% of it. So it just doesn't matter. Like, I'm going to do what's right. And I think that ruthlessness is what you need. If you really want to run a championship organization and you really want to compete at the highest level, you have to have ruthlessness and you have to be willing to die, you know, for what you believe in. And that's hard to do when a salary, you depend on the salary, you know, for that. And you depend on people liking you and you depend on this organization that's been built up around you for hundreds of years before you got there. Like, you care about respecting it. You care about the traditions of it, which I'm not saying you shouldn't. But when an owner, I never forgot that the owner of the Reds signed my check and I owe him wins and I owe him, I don't owe anyone else. Like, the owner's the one paying me a hell of a lot of money to work in baseball. So I never forget that that's the guy that, like, we need to win and we need to build this organization to win. Like, that's what I believe in. And it just turns out that a lot of people don't believe in that. And that was probably one of the more sad things I learned while working in professional sports, which sucks.
Risk of Ruin is written and produced by me. Special thanks to Kyle Bodie for being generous with his time. I'll put some links in the show notes so you can learn more about Kyle and Driveline Baseball. If you want to get in touch with the show, you can subscribe to the Substack. You can also email us, riskofruinpod@gmail.com, and you can follow us on Twitter @HeffKelly.